From the trusted team behind 48 Hours, welcome to Case by Case, your weekly update on the biggest true crime stories unfolding right now.
Nick Reiner remains in custody without bail.
Luigi Mangione accused of stalking and gunning down United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson.
From high-profile trials and stunning evidence to major breaks in cold cases, we'll follow it all case by case. Follow and listen to 48 Hours Case by Case wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie. When you use Angie for your home projects, you know all your jobs will be done well. Roof repair? Done well. Kitchen sink install? Done well. Deck upgrades? Done well. Electrical upgrade? Done well. Angie's been connecting homeowners with skilled pros for nearly 30 years, so we know the difference between done and done well.
Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find a pro for your project at Angie.com.
Every week on the Moth Podcast, real people tell their stories live on stage.
I burst into tears, and I wasn't sure if I was crying because I hadn't been kissed in a really long time, or if I had just never been kissed like that before.
To hear fascinating, heartbreaking, and sometimes hilarious stories from astronauts, teachers, farmers, and people just like you, follow and listen to The Moth wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Face Connecticut, an in-depth look at today's issues.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Face Connecticut on WTIC News Talk 1080, 96.5 TICFM and Light 100.5 WRCH. Aaron Kupek with you this Sunday morning, and we are pleased to be joined by the forester for the state of Connecticut, Chris Martin. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, fall foliage season is getting underway in Connecticut and across the Northeast. Tell us what the forecast is for our parts this year.
Well, I think we're going to have a vivid year. It's been a great summer with plenty of rain and moderate temperatures. July was hot, but we've cooled off a bit now. And I think the stage is set for a great foliage season.
What ingredients in particular go into making it a good foliage season?
There's really three main ingredients. One is the number of daylight hours, which is consistent year to year. The other, precipitation during the spring and summer. We want well-watered trees. Good soil moisture to help the trees grow so they go into the fall healthy. And then finally is our overnight temperatures in September, which really this time of year is the greatest variable, which really times out when exactly we'll hit peak foliage in October.
And what you want is those kind of cool nights, right?
Yeah, evenings, overnight temperatures in the 40s are ideal.
What does that trigger within trees?
So the daylight hours, the shortening, triggers the trees to shut down. But as the temperatures drop, it really affects the flow of nutrients up and down the trees, and it closes down the trees quicker, which leaves the colors out in the leaves more pronounced.
What determines what type of colors you see in leaves?
Well, there are different pigments and different chemical compounds, and I won't get into the scientific names. However, different tree species have more prominent different chemical compounds or pigments. And that's why sugar maples, the classic brilliant orange, ash, tulip poplar turn yellow, hickory's also yellow, and then our oaks turn more of a purpley, brownish orange type thing.
Are some trees more quick to turn than others?
They are. There's some trees that are under stress, whether it be some damage or age or disease, will turn earlier, or if they're on growing sites such as shallow soils, or overly wet soils. Our wetlands will turn, the red maple swamps will turn before the upland areas. And then trees that are in really healthy, deep loamy soils, they'll be the very last to change in a certain specific area.
We're already seeing a little color out there. Walk us through when peak will be.
Peak does go north to south, and we usually like to say Columbus Day weekend, mid-October-ish, is when we really will start to see those greatest colors in our higher elevations in northeastern and northwestern Connecticut. From there, we move southward into the Hartford area about a week or so after Columbus Day. And then our very last area in Connecticut, typically lower Middlesex County, Essex, the mouth of the Connecticut River, and that is first, second week of November. Connecticut, I think, stands out amongst other states because of that graduation. It's gradual, and our tree diversity is one of the greatest in New England state. So we have in my mind, more colors, more diversity, and a longer foliage season because of that.
I understand the phone has already been ringing off the hook with people wanting to know, when is peak going to occur and where should I go?
Many folks think the state forester is the foliage czar and can tell you exactly when and where to be. So most people do understand there's variability place to place and year to year. But that said, we take calls at our agency from across the world. Artists from Italy, France come, California. You know, people don't realize, many people realize the beauty of Connecticut. But when you live here all the time, you kind of see it all the time, it gets a little dull. When you grow up in an area that's devoid of the variety of trees we have, the foliage season is really a huge attractant for tourism.
Yeah, I may be asking you to divulge a secret, but do you have a favorite place for foliage in Connecticut?
That is a tough question. We have, for me personally, I like to see vistas, and I like to see the landscape. So high precipices that have views of our valleys and our farms and our diversified woodlands are some of my favorites. And we actually have some recommended hiking locations on our website under Fall Foliage. We have several web pages devoted to that with recommended hikes and drives and specific locations where you can take your family out and really have a delightful weekend.
How good a foliage season was it last year?
Last year was good. We had very similar to this year, actually. We had a great setup with wetter summer and spring. And then the temperatures did finally cool off. It took a little bit longer towards the end of September. And I think we were a little bit later last year than normal, but, you know, well within the realm of normalcy.
How long do the leaves stay on the trees and what dictates that?
So, yeah, that's a great question because, and certainly in the news lately, we've heard all about the terrible weather in the southeast of the Bahamas. We do are in hurricane season. And so as we reach that peak color, and as the leaves are, you know, at their brightest, are also the most vulnerable to falling off because of heavy rain and wind. And it doesn't take much for us to have, you know, all kinds of leaves, all kinds of colors, and then the very next day look like end of November. They can all fall down at once. So wind, rain, and then if we get a really, really hard frost, if it gets really cold, they'll shrivel up a little bit and then fall off more quickly.
So essentially, enjoy it while you can.
Make the most of it, yes.
Are there any sort of diseases or critters that affect the foliage?
Oh, there's a variety. And you know, because our tree diversity is so wide with all kinds of different species, there's different things out there that affect trees year to year. And some of our native insects and diseases, leaf tar spot, you know, they're here and there. They do show up. But the trees and those things have kind of learned to live together, and so they usually don't have a big impact. We do, however, also have some invasive species that have impacted our forests in a big way. Gypsy moth caterpillar last few years, mostly in eastern Connecticut and New London and then Tolland County in particular. But then also we have the emerald ash borer affecting ash trees, and that is making a eastward march from western Connecticut to eastern Connecticut.
Now, with the gypsy moths, I understand the activity has died down a bit, but in some areas the damage has been done.
Yeah, we recently have come out of a very large infestation. About every 10 years or so, Connecticut seems to be impacted in a big way. And we had 3 years of spring drought, which really enabled the caterpillar populations to grow in number tremendously. Thankfully, that has ended. We've had two wet springs, so they have succumbed to the Bamenga fungus, which is a soil fungus. So this past 2 years, we've had very little new feeding activity. However, as you noted, we do have mortality, some dead trees from the significant defoliation and several years of it coupled with drought. And so there are pockets of mostly oak and predominantly white oak that people are seeing along their roadsides in their backyards that are posing a risk for us. And our agency, DEEP, has been very aggressive taking down those trees in public areas where people like to congregate, parking areas, picnic grounds, and whatnot. And then we do know that landowners, homeowners in particular, many have been hit hard in the pocketbook because these things are often big. And when you take a tree down around houses and garages and driveways and whatnot, you got to be very careful and often requires an expert to provide that service.
How does the gypsy moth kill the tree? Is it just going after the leaves, or does it go after the wood as well?
So it definitely is a defoliator, which is a leaf eater. And the leaves on a tree are critical to the tree's sustenance. I mean, that is basically the mouth parts of the tree. It takes in the nutrients, it processes them, you know, provides carbohydrates and all kinds of things for the tree to grow. But when you take down those leaves, you remove them during the growing season in particular, you're basically starving the tree. And so, you know, trees will survive 1 year, maybe two, as long as they can refoliate and get nutrients and water again. But repeated defoliation year after year, coupled with drought, and the fact that our trees are older, they're not quite as spry as they used to be. You know, they're tired and they just can't handle it. We had similar outbreaks in the 1980s, generally speaking, when our forest was younger. And our forest was more resilient back then. And the mortality, therefore, was much less than what we're seeing today.
Now, you also mentioned the emerald ash borer, which is newer to Connecticut. What does that do?
Yeah, so this guy showed up in 2014, Prospect, Connecticut, the epicenter. And we believe it probably came in some wood pallet material from Asia, which many of our invasive species originate from. That has since spread to most all of Connecticut. All counties have it. It takes about 3 to 5 years for people actually to realize it's around because it's such a very small boring beetle. When you see one, though, emerald green, it really stands out. But they grow in number quickly, and they are targeted towards ash. They basically cut the blood flow off of the tree by boring in just below the cambium, near the hardwood, where all those nutrients flow up and down the stem of the tree, basically strangulating the tree through their gallering. And so the ash trees are succumbing. They're dead along roadsides and, again, in people's backyards and in the woods, and causing a lot of concern for people.
Is there anything we can do to fight these critters?
There is. In fact, a lot of strategies out there, especially for municipalities, are to manage the death of these ash trees in particular, and also oak, where you can treat trees to kill the emerald ash borer and gypsy moth and to kind of slow down that death rate over time. And that's really important for towns and even for folks with many trees for their cash flow. You know, taking all these trees down at once and removing them is very, very expensive. So if you have a legacy tree, you can treat them. It does require a licensed arborist with a pesticides applicator to provide the chemicals to do that properly and safely. There's certain times of year when it can be done and when it shouldn't be done because we also have other concerns for pollination. But that can be successfully treated without any harm to the environment and keep those trees alive. And probably every 2 years or so, that treatment has to take place.
You are listening to Face Connecticut. We are talking to State Forester Chris Martin. I know when we were trying to prevent the emerald ash borer from coming to Connecticut, not importing out-of-state firewood was important. Is that still important?
It is. It is. And, you know, I will say that we were successful slowing down the spread of emerald ash borer and allowing folks to become educated and prepared. It was basically found on the western side of the Hudson River at a KOA campground about 3 or 4 years prior to it getting into Connecticut. And in fact, when it hit Connecticut, it wasn't because of a westward migration. It was a hop, skip, and a jump from somewhere else that showed up in Prospect and then worked west and east from Prospect. We have another very scary critter in Worcester, Massachusetts, the Asian longhorn beetle. And that helped us promulgate firewood regulations in Connecticut, where bringing in out-of-state firewood does require a permit. Now, let me just say that that permit is no cost. We want to know about firewood coming into Connecticut. Therefore, we welcome people to let us know, and we make it easy. And it's not that it's a straight-out prohibition, but anything that's coming from an area near Worcester, Massachusetts, really runs a risk of carrying that beetle into Connecticut. And the Asian longhorn beetle, unlike gypsy moth, unlike emerald ash borer, has a voracious appetite for a wide variety of tree species. And so, as we mentioned before, our forests are very diverse. And so this guy is really bad news for Connecticut. And the sooner we find it, if it does show up in Connecticut, the better off we'll be. The one benefit of Asian longhorn beetle, it's a big, charismatic beetle, doesn't move well on its own, so it can be contained, and in other parts of the country, has been successfully eradicated.
You know, driving around Connecticut, you see so many streets named after elm and chestnut and other trees that really don't thrive in this part of the country anymore. Walk us through the history of what happened to some of those.
Yeah, so, you know, we talk about these invasive critters like it's something new that's never happened before. And in fact, we've been dealing with it since the early 1900s and maybe even before that. But it was, these things have come in from global trade and global travel. The Dutch elm disease back in the 30s and 20s came in and really just devastated our forests and also a lot of our urban areas, because the elm tree, because of its silhouette and growth pattern, is ideal tree for urban settings. It's tall, it clears the utility lines, and has a very nice flowering canopy, which really provides cooling and nice shade for our summer heat. That has since succumbed. There are elms still around, but they are also treated annually or very periodically to keep the Dutch elm disease at bay. The other sad story is the chestnut tree blight, which chestnuts used to make up the majority tree species in Connecticut and was a founding lumber species for many of our buildings back in the 17, 1800s. In fact, there's many barns and older industrial buildings that have these huge, you know, monstrous chestnut beams, and they're such rugged, strong buildings that they've stood all this time, standed this test of time, and it's sad to see that go. You know, those trees provided unique wildlife habitat and food with the mast, and basically have been replaced with oak trees, which provide similar benefits.
Now, chestnut trees will still grow. They just don't grow very big, right?
Yeah, many people will see them in the woods or in even their woodland backyard edges where they sprout up year after year. And they'll get maybe 4 or 6 inches in diameter, but then they'll all of a sudden see the stem of it start to blister with orange and whatnot. And basically, that's just the blight coming in and hammering the tree.
What can the average person do to help with tree health, maybe in their yard or, you know, across Connecticut?
Well, I think first thing is to be informed. Know the tree species in your backyard. Become familiar with them. Be an advocate for tree health and tree planting and for healthy forests. And it's a variety of opportunities, be it a land trust, local conservation league, even being a Friends of a State Forest. You know, there's all kinds of opportunity for people to engage and learn more about trees. Informed public is probably our best advocate because they can see things early. You know, by the way, most of these early pest detections have occurred not by foresters or pathologists, entomologists, scientific folks. It's the regular folks that are just like curious and interested in the health of their trees, and they see something not right, they say something. And it's a huge benefit for early detection.
In terms of tree care, what should someone look for in someone who's going to be taking down or trimming a tree? I'm guessing not the person who shows up at your front door unsolicited with a ladder.
So there's a lot of folks out there that want to get into the tree business, and there's a lot of people that need tree service. So with that comes some risk of some, you know, maybe not so best business practices. But homeowners and property owners can protect themselves by soliciting service from more than one vendor, getting references. Always have a written quote and details on the work that's prescribed. The last thing a homeowner wants or anybody wants is a surprise. And another consideration is when people come onto your property, make sure they're insured. But then also be aware of where they're going to go with the equipment. Are there underground hazards, whether it be utility lines or a septic tank? These things really need to be made known to the contractor so you don't end up having ancillary issues along with the tree being taken down.
I know cities and towns have tree wardens in some cases. Do they interface at all with you?
So, yes, all the time. And I will just say that our tree wardens these days are some of the best folks on the ground, town by town, that know about tree health. Recently, last few years ago, the legislature passed a new law that requires tree wardens to be qualified. Although many knew their business, there was, you know, people coming and going all the time. Now the tree wardens have to be qualified. And University of Connecticut Extension Service provides that training on behalf of the Commissioner of DEEP to get those folks fully trained and ready for their jobs. So your tree warden in your town knows the trees, knows the health, and they're a great go-to resource for trees that are within the municipal right-of-way. Many folks think the tree warden in town can take care of their private trees. Not the case. But certainly trees in parks around schools and then within that right-of-way, which does vary on your town roads from 10, 15 feet from the curb inland on your grass or wooded area to the center line of the road. So there's a lot of variability. So it's always good to check with the tree warden if you have a problem tree near the road.
As you noted, because we live in Connecticut and we see lots of trees every day, we might not think of this, but how forested a state are we compared to others?
So, and this statistic surprises people because we are very heavily developed as a state. But if you look at the map of the United States, Connecticut ranks in the top 10 for number of trees per acre and as far as canopy coverage goes. I like to say that Connecticut residents are forest dwellers. And people, you know, scratch their head. What does that mean? Well, if you look out your window or you just step out your backyard, you cannot help but see a tree. We live underneath a forest of trees, whether it be a suburban, urban, or rural area. And that really poses Connecticut, you know, unlike other states and that are envious of us, like the Midwest and even the West Coast, you know, it's certainly the Southeast United States, because we have such a great tree canopy. And oftentimes people visit Connecticut from those areas and they feel kind of claustrophobic because just like there's trees like everywhere, all above me, all around me. And don't you feel like closed in? And of course, here we celebrate that.
I'm guessing we probably have more trees now than we did at other times during our history when they were used more for burning and building.
Oh, we do. In fact, we hit a low point in the mid-1800s, early 1800s, where about maybe 20, 30% of the state had trees. We're now basically, we're 100% covered, and our core forest areas represent maybe 50%, 58%. But we were missing a lot of trees back in the mid-1800s because of agricultural clearing and charcoal making. And that actually brought about a lot of the laws in Connecticut that were kind of first in the nation, such as tree wardens, arborist registrations and licensing, consumer protection based upon tree care. Really, Connecticut led that front early on. And because of that, I think we have great qualified folks today, and we have a pretty healthy forest.
Do trees play a role in helping to regulate the climate and the environment?
They do in a big, big way, both on a very small scale and a large scale. I like to say trees are our world's lungs. They take in carbon dioxide, they store it in wood, and they transpire oxygen, which we need. So trees and humans, we have kind of a symbiotic relationship. On the micro scale, our heating and cooling are greatly influenced by trees. And particularly in the summer, the shading of trees around buildings can significantly reduce your energy costs. Also, you know, getting back to the carbon component of trees, we do a great job in Connecticut in locking up carbon long-term by harvesting our saw logs, trees when they're mature, and making usable forest products out of them, whether it be cabinetry, flooring, furniture. And that basically removes a carbon piece from the woods, locks it up into a usable product for a long, long period of time. And then where that tree was, more trees grow. And so we have even more carbon being sequestered because of the regeneration. And most of that happens in Connecticut naturally.
It does seem we have kind of a love-hate relationship, though. I think back to the October nor'easter in 2011 when trees were falling down all over the place.
Well, yeah. And so, yeah, 2011 was a pretty tough year. Superstorm Sandy, too. We had two events basically blackened Connecticut for 3 to 4 weeks. In many people's minds, that does seem like yesterday. And that's reflective of our age of our forests in Connecticut. We have an overabundance of big, yet beautiful trees. But as in most things in biological cycles, everything comes to the end stage of their life. And so, you know, when trees reach 100, 125, 150 years, which is reflective back to our mid-1800s when we were mostly less of trees. Now we have a lot of trees similar in age class. we are kind of vulnerable. And it does show when we have catastrophic weather events. The solution to that, I think, is forest management and sustainable, responsible forest management. We can keep a diversity of trees, different age classes that can respond to these type of weather events that seem to be a little more dramatic than they used to be years ago.
He is State Forester Chris Martin. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, it's a great time. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Face Connecticut. I'm Aaron Kupek. Enjoy the balance of your weekend.
Face Connecticut is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTIC Radio.
Understanding power requires more than headlines. I'm Peter Hamby, host of The Powers That Be, a podcast from PUC examining politics, economics, and media to provide context, analysis, and clarity without sensationalism. We ask how power operates, who benefits, and what's at stake. If you want to move beyond breaking news to deeper understanding, join us on The Powers That Be. New episodes every weekday. Follow The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.